hours of neglected homework to Mark. I should have reminded myself that I was a teacher, not a card shark. I drove a Toyota, brought my coffee from Costa and my sandwiches from M&S. That was my world. I should have walked away, got a cab home, and got on with my life. That's what I should have done. But I didn't. I said, "Where?" And later, much later, when I realized I was out of my depth, when the debts had begun to pile at my feet like unexploded grenades, when I had sold the Toyota, left my job, been turned down by every lender, when I was dragged into the back of a van one night to find Gloria sitting there, smiling her American cheerleader meets American psycho smile. That's when I said, "No. Please, no." I don't limp these days because of a car accident 25 years ago, although I did for a while. But that limp had gone, the scars long healed, when Gloria placed one candy floss pink nail against my lips and whispered sweetly, "Don't beg, Joe. I can't bear a man who begs." I stopped begging and started screaming. She taps her nails against the steering wheel. A glittery red tonight. Human League blasts out of the stereo. Every atom cramps in terror. The other thing Gloria likes, aside from hurting people, is 80s music. I can't listen to Cyndi Lauper without rushing to the toilet to vomit. It makes 80s nights something of a no-no. "How did you find me?"
"I have my ways." My heart stalls.
"Not Brendan?"
"Oh, no. Brendan's just fine."
She gives me a chiding look.
"I don't go around hurting people for no reason. Not even you."
I feel relief and stupidly gratitude. Then something occurs to me. "What about the other two? The ones who attacked me?"
"Ah, Dumb and Dumber. Dislocated shoulder and a broken nose. I went easy. Didn't take much for them to run off."
"No, I think. I bet it didn't." Gloria might look like a delicate china doll, but the only doll she has anything in common with is Chucky. Rumour has it she was a child gymnast who changed her speciality to martial arts. She was banned from competitions after putting an opponent in a coma. The woman is fast, strong, and knows every vulnerable spot in the human body. Some, even anatomists, haven't discovered yet. She glances at me.
"They'd have killed you if I hadn't intervened."
"And served you a job," she tuts.
"You're no good to me dead. Dead men do not pay their debts."
Reassuring.
"And the fat man still wants his cash."
"Do people really call him that? Or is it just a name he got from a comic book?" She chuckles throatily.
"You see, that's exactly the type of comment that makes him hire people like me to hurt you."
"Nice chap. I must meet him one day."
"I wouldn't recommend it."
"I'm working on getting the money. I have a new job."
"Joe, forgive me for being blunt, but a few quid here and there is not going to cut it. 30 grand. That's what the fat man wants."
30? But that's way more.
"Next month they'll want 40. You know how this works."
"I do." I nod.
"I have a plan."
"I'm listening."
"There's a man here who wants me to leave the village. Badly."
"This wouldn't be the same man who got those thugs to beat you up tonight."
"Yes."
"And now he's going to hand you a big wad of cash?"
"Yes."
"And why is he going to have this change of heart?"
"Because of what happened."
what he did.
Because, as he said himself, he has a nice life here, and I could screw it all up, just like that.
He owes me, I say, and he really doesn't want me stirring up trouble for him.
Interesting. Who is this man?
A counsellor and successful businessman. She signals to turn into the village.
I like a public figure. There are just so many ways to fuck up their lives, don't you think?
I've never given it that much thought.
Oh, you should. They're the easiest ones to hurt. The ones with the most to lose.
In that case, I should be unbreakable.
Well, no one is that. But physical pain is the easiest to recover from.
Right now, just about every part of my body would beg to disagree, but I don't reply. Talking about pain with Gloria is a bad idea, like taking a poacher on safari. We drive along in silence for a while. She sighs.
I like you, Joe.
Do you have a funny way of showing it?
I sense a hint of sarcasm.
You crippled me.
Actually, I saved you from being a cripple.
She pulls up outside the cottage and yanks on the handbrake.
The fat man wanted me to ruin your good leg.
She turns and rests a hand gently on my thigh.
Luckily for you, being a daft little woman from Manchester, I got a bit confused.
I stare at her. You want me to thank you? She smiles again. It would be a nice smile, if it made it anywhere near her dead blue eyes. If the eyes are the windows to the soul, Gloria's reveal nothing but empty rooms covered in blood-spattered sheets. She runs her hand down my thigh to my knee, and then she squeezes hard.
For a tiny woman, she has a powerful grip. In other circumstances, this might be a good thing. Right now, all my breath is sucked out of my diaphragm. I'm in too much pain to even scream. Just when I think I might pass out, she releases me. I gasp and fall back in my seat. I don't want you to thank me. I want you to get me that 30 grand. Because next time, I won't be so fucking forgiving.
12.
Don't tell me, Beth says. I should see the steamroller.
I try to raise an eyebrow. It hurts. Just about everything hurts this morning. The only consolation is that it makes the pain in my leg bearable by comparison.
Very funny.
I sit down at the canteen table next to her.
Excuse me if I don't laugh, but I don't want to rupture anything.
She regards me with a smidge more compassion. Either that or she has something stuck in her throat.
What happened?
I fell down the stairs.
Really?
The very steep stairs.
Right. Easy to trip.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like you don't believe me.
She shrugs.
I just wondered if you'd managed to piss someone else off.
You have a very low opinion of me.
No, I just have a very high opinion of your ability to be annoying.
I chuckle. Predictably, it hurts.
Well, she says, at least you can laugh about it.
Barely. Her face softens.
Seriously, are you okay? If there's anything you want to talk about.
Before I can respond, I catch a whiff of halitosis mixed with bad aftershave. I cough and push my sandwich to one side. To be fair, I wasn't very hungry anyway.
Joey, man.
I thought I couldn't hate him anymore, but the addition of an E on the end of my name has just made it possible. Simon drags out a chair and sits down. Today, He wears a magic roundabout t-shirt over maroon cords. Maroon.
Wow, what happened to your face, man? Or should I see the other guy?
He has really badly bruised knuckles, Beth quips. Simon gives a feeble laugh. I sense he doesn't really like women who are smart or funny. Makes him feel inferior. Rightly so. And actually, my face got off lightly. Just a bruised eye and a cut lip. I fell down the stairs, I say.
Really?
He shakes his head. I thought it might have had something to do with Stephen Hurst. I stare at him.
What?
I saw you two talking in the pub last night.
You were there?
Just having a quiet pint.
And spying on me.
The thought leaps into my head unbidden. Paranoid?
Maybe.
But why not introduce himself?
I didn't want to interrupt,
he says. A rehearsed lie, if ever I've heard one.
What does talking to Stephen Hurst have to do with anything?
I ask innocently.
If we're going to play Pretty Little Liars here, I bet I can win.
Simon smiles.
I really wish he wouldn't.
Well, between you, me and the lamppost, Stephen Hurst might give the impression of being a respectable counsellor, but rumour has it he isn't averse to using less professional methods when people upset him.
Meaning?
Meaning, Beth says, Jeremy Hurst had a run-in with our last head of PE. Before the guy resigned, he had a run-in with someone's fists on the way home one night.
She glances at me and I realise she knows. She knew from the minute I sat, painfully, down.
Well, you shouldn't listen to rumours,
I say evenly.
Good point,
Simon says, opening his chicken sandwich noisily and taking a bite, noisily. I bet he even sleeps noisily.
Reminds me, though, he mumbles.
You remember Carol Webster?
Sorry?
At Stockford Academy. She was deputy head.
I try to keep a neutral face, even as my heart picks up pace, like a jogger with the finishing line in sight. Except I'm not quite so happy about where this road is leading.
Afraid not?
Actually, I do. She was a vastly overweight woman with a huge halo of curly dark hair and a face that looked permanently disappointed. With herself, the school, or the world in general, I was never sure.
Well, she and I keep in touch on Facebook.
Of course you do, I think.
Facebook is the place where people with no friends in real life keep in touch with people they'd never want to be friends with in real life.
That's nice.
She remembers you.
Or rather, she remembers you leaving.
Yeah?
It was about the same time all that money from the school safe went missing.
I regard him steadily.
I think you've got your facts wrong. I heard the money was returned.
He makes a pretense of stroking his chin.
Oh, yeah. I suppose that's why the police never got involved. Got kind of hushed up.
Beth looks at Simon.
Are you accusing Mr. Thorne of something here? Because you're being about as subtle as a friggin' tank.
He holds up his hands in mock surrender.
Oh, no. Not at all. Just saying that's why she remembered him. Timing.
Talking of which, he glances at his watch.
I have a kid I need to see about a detention.
He stands, grabbing his sandwich.
Catch you later.
Yeah, I say. Catch you later.
Not if we get immunised against you first,
Beth mutters, smiling sweetly. I watch Simon's departing back and wish for a crater to suddenly open up beneath him, or perhaps for the ceiling to cave in, or an instance of spontaneous human combustion.
Don't let him get to you, Beth says.
He hasn't.
Bullshit. Simon is a bloody awful teacher, but one thing he excels at is getting under other people's skin. If you have an Achilles heel, he'll find it and nip at it like a starving terrier.
Thanks for the mental image.
You're welcome.
She pops a piece of pasta into her mouth.
Not true, is it?
What?
You didn't really nick all the money from your last school?
No.
I intended to. I really had sunk that low.
but when it came to it, I couldn't. Because someone else had got there before me.
Sorry, Beth says.
Shouldn't have even asked. It's okay.
I mean, I know Harry was desperate for a new English teacher because, let's face it, the position is a bit of a poison chalice.
Like I said, forget it.
But even Harry wouldn't...
Forget it.
I've snapped.
She stares at me.
I don't want to piss off the one ally I have here.
I'm sorry, I say. I'm just in a bit of pain and...
No, it's fine.
She shakes her head. Silver earrings glint.
Sometimes I don't know when to shut up.
It's not that. My phone buzzes in my pocket. I'd like to ignore it, but then again, it might be Gloria. Gloria made it pretty clear last night that she isn't about to be ignored.
Sorry, I say again. I just need to... Go ahead.
I slip the phone out of my pocket and glance at the screen. It's not Gloria. I stare at the text message. My skin prickles with a million tiny icy pitchforks.
Something wrong?
Yes.
No.
I slip the phone back into my pocket. I've just remembered I have to be somewhere.
Now?
Right now.
You've got class in 30 minutes.
I'll be back.
Good to know, Arnie.
I shrug on my jacket and wince.
I'll see you later. Watch your step.
I frown. Why?
She cocks an eyebrow. You don't want to fall down any more stairs now, do you?
13. St. Jude's is a small, soot-crusted building that looks more like a run-down scout hut than a village church. There is no spire, just an uneven, unpitted roof. Tiles missing, holes in places. The windows are grilled, the door boarded up. The only congregations filling its pews and raising the rafters are the nesting crows and pigeons. I push open the gate and walk up the rutted pathway. The churchyard is similarly neglected. It hasn't been used for burials for a very long time. My sister and my parents were cremated at the large crematorium in Mansfield. The headstones here are chipped and cracked, the inscriptions eroded by the weather and the passing of the years, some completely worn away. Tree roots have undermined a few of the oldest graves, toppling them over to be reclaimed by the grass and weeds. We try so hard, I think, to mark our place on this earth. To leave something of ourselves. But in the end, even those markers are transitory, impermanent. We can't fight against time. It's like trying to run uphill on an ever-accelerating, descending escalator. Time is always moving, always busy, always cleaning up after itself, removing the detritus of the old and sweeping in the new. I walk slowly around the church to the rear. The ground rises a little. There are fewer headstones. I stand and look around.
For a moment, I can't see her. Maybe she's gone.
Maybe the text was just some...
And then I spot her, lurking at the far end of the graveyard, half hidden, overgrown with ivy and creepers.
The angel. Not a memorial or a headstone. Apparently, she was placed here in the Victorian era by the owners of the pit. Some say it was after the family's twin daughters died as infants. But the grave was once exhumed, something to do with the church being worried about it being unmarked, and no human remains were discovered beneath. No one really knows where she came from, or to what purpose. She doesn't even look much like an angel these days. Her hands are broken stumps, and her head is gone. She tilts a little, unsteady on her square stone feet. The once gracefully flowing robes are chipped and broken, crusted with furry moss, as though nature has wrapped an extra layer around her to keep her stony bones warm. I bend down. A new and interesting burst of pain reminding me that I need to take some more painkillers soon and brush away moss and grass from the base. The inscription is a little faded but still legible. But Jesus said, "Suffer, little children, and forbid them not to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." I look again at the message on my phone. Suffocate the little children. Fuck them. Rest in pieces. A long time ago, a gang of teenagers sprayed graffiti all over the angel. The same ones who brought a shovel and scythed off her head and hands, decapitating and maiming her. There was no real reason for the attack, just mindless vandalism, spurred on by cheap cider and teenage bravado. The dismemberment and spray cans had been Hearst's idea, but the words, I'm ashamed to say, were mine. At the time, with a bladder full of booze and the jeering encouragement of the rest of our gang, I had felt pretty pleased with myself. Later, hanging over the toilet spewing up bile and shame, I had felt like shit. I wasn't religious, none of my family was, but I still knew what we had done was wrong. Even 25 years later, I feel discomfort at the memory. Funny how the good memories flit by like butterflies, fleeting, fragile, impossible to capture without crushing them. But the bad ones, the guilt, the shame, they hang on in there, like parasites, quietly eating you away from the inside. 4 of us were here that day. Hearst, me, Fletch and Chris. Marie was absent. She hung around with our gang more and more, much to the irritation of Fletch, who resented a girl in our midst, but not all the time. Hearst probably told her about it, though. And in a school, word gets around. Rumours spread. Just because we were the only ones here that day doesn't mean that no one else knew. Still, it does mean that whoever sent the text must have been at school with us back then. Perhaps the same person who sent the email. I tried to call the number. It went to answer phone. I sent a text. I'm not expecting a reply. I don't think the sender wanted a conversation. They wanted me to come here. But why? I straighten and stare at the headless angel. She steadfastly refuses to offer me any divine enlightenment. I wonder what happened to her head and hands. The church probably stored them away, or maybe some weirdo took them for a memento to keep under their floorboards. Better than a real head, I suppose. I'm missing something. Something obvious. I regard the angel's oddly tilted posture. And then it comes to me. I walk around the back and crouch down again. Where the roots of the creepers have started to push her from the ground, there's a hollow. A recess in the damp earth. Something has been wedged underneath. I stick my hand in, grimacing at the feel of the cold, dank soil. There's a package of some sort in there, bound up in plastic. It takes a couple of tugs and I pull it out, shaking off dirt and a few slugs and earwigs. I study the package, turning it over in my hands. A4 sized, about half the thickness of an average paperback. It's been wrapped in a bin bag and secured with electrical tape. I'm going to need scissors to open it, which means I need to get back to school. I slip the package inside my satchel, along with my notebooks and some essays I should probably be marking right now. I buckle the satchel up, stand and walk more briskly back around the church. I'm almost to the gate when I realize I'm not alone. A figure is sitting on the church's only small bench, beneath an aged sycamore. A familiar, skinny, hunched figure. My heart sinks. Not now. I need to get back to school. I need to open the package. I don't need to play the concerned teacher or the good bloody Samaritan. But then, another part of me, the irritating part, the part that actually gives a shit about kids and got me into teaching in the first place, gets the better of me. I walk over to the bench. Marcus? He starts, and looks up, flinching slightly. The reaction of someone who only ever expects an insult or a blow. What are you doing here? I ask. He shifts, embarrassed, red-faced.
Nothing.
Right. I wait. Because that's what you have to do sometimes. You don't push to get kids to tell you things. You pull back. Let them ease it out on their own. He sighs.
I come here to eat my lunch.
It's on the tip of my tongue to ask why, but that would be stupid. Why did Ruth Moore eat her lunch in the bus shelter down the road from school every day? Because it was safer. A place to hide from the bullies. Better a urine-stinking shelter or a damp bench in a cold graveyard than the ritual humiliation of the canteen and the playground.
Are you going to bollock me for being off school premises?
Marcus asks. I sit down beside him, trying not to grimace at the fresh twinge in my back.
No, although I'm curious as to how you found a way past the security gates.
Like I tell you.
Fair point.
I look around.
Isn't there a better place to hang out? Not in Arnhill.
Also a fair point.
Are you here to avoid Hurst?
What do you think?
Look,
if you're going to give me some lecture about how I should stand up to Hurst because bullies respect you if you stand up to them, then you can take that crap and stuff it right back in your stupid satchel, along with your copy of The Guardian.
He glares at me defiantly. And he's right. Bullies don't respect you if you fight back. They just beat you harder. Because there are always more of them. A simple equation of numbers. I try again. I'm not going to tell you that, Marcus, because it is crap. The best thing you can do is keep your head down, keep away from Hurst, and get through as best you can. You won't be at school forever, even though it feels that way now. But you can come to me. I'll deal with Hurst. You can count on that.
He stares at me for a moment, trying to decide whether I'm feeding him a line or he really can trust me.
It could go either way. Then he gives me a very small nod.
It's not just me. Hurst picks on loads of kids. Everyone's shit scared of him. Even the other teachers.
I think about what Beth said in the pub. About Hurst being in Julia Morton's form group. About Ben going missing. What about Mrs. Morton? She was his form tutor last year, wasn't she?
Yeah. She wasn't scared of him. She was more like you.
Bearing in mind she killed her son and blew her own head off, I'm not sure whether to take that as a compliment. Did you know Ben Morton? I ask.
Not really. He was only a first year.
What about Hurst? Did Hurst bully Ben?
He shakes his head. Hurst didn't pick on Ben. Ben was popular. He had mates.
He hesitates. But there was something. He throws me a sideways glance.
A lot of the younger kids, they want to impress Hurst, be on his good side, be one of his gang.
And?
Hurst would make them do stuff to prove themselves.
Like an initiation?
He nods.
What sort of stuff?
Just stupid dares and things. Pathetic, really.
On school premises?
No. There's this place Hurst knows about, up on the old colliery site.
My blood slows and chills. On the old colliery site? Or under it? Did he find something up there? Tunnels? Caves? My voice has risen. He stares at me.
I don't know, okay? I never wanted to be one of Hurst's fucking gang.
I've pushed too hard. And he does know. He's just not ready to say yet. I already have a pretty good idea anyway. For now, I let the moment slide. We can come back to it another time. With kids like Marcus, there's always another time. Hurst might be indiscriminate in his bullying, but like parents, every bully has a favourite, even if they don't say so. I glance around the graveyard again.
You know, when I was a kid, we used to hang around here sometimes.
You did?
Yeah, we'd vandalize angels.
Drink, smoke, other stuff. I probably shouldn't be telling you this.
I like to look at the old graves, he says. The people's names. I like to imagine what their lives were like.
Short, hard and miserable, I think. That's what most people's lives were like in the 19th century. We romanticise the past with our period dramas and glossy film adaptations, a bit like we do with nature. Nature isn't beautiful. Nature is violent, unpredictable, and unforgiving. Eat or be eaten. That's nature. However much Attenborough and Coldplay you wrap it up in.
Most people had hard lives back then, I say to Marcus.
He nods, suddenly enthused.
I know. Do you know the average age people lived to in the 19th century?
I hold up my hands. English, not history.
46, if you were lucky. And Arnhill was an industrial village. Lower class manual workers died younger. Lung infections, mine accidents, and of course, all the usual diseases. Smallpox, typhoid, etc., etc.
Not the best time to be born. His eyes light up. I sense we have found his chosen subject.
That's the other thing. In the 1800s, women had an average of 8 or 10 children, but many would die in infancy, or before they reached the teens.
He pauses to let this sink in.
Ever notice something weird about this place?
I look around. You mean, aside from all the dead people? His face closes again. He thinks I'm making fun of him. Sorry. Flippancy. Bad habit of mine. Tell me.
What's missing from the graveyard?
I look around.
There is something.
Something obvious. Something I should have noticed before. I can feel it at the back of my mind, but I can't quite grasp it. I shake my head. Go on.
There's not one baby or young person buried here.
He stares at me triumphantly.
Where are all the children?
14. When Annie was about 3, she asked me,
Where are all the snowmen?
It wasn't quite so random. It was November, and it had snowed quite heavily a couple of days before. All the kids in the village had run outside, chucking snowballs around and rolling them into huge misshapen lumps that looked nothing like snowmen you see in films or on Christmas cards. Real snowmen never do. They're usually far from round, and the snow is never white, mixed in with a fair bit of mud, grass, and occasionally dog shit. Still, that weekend there were lots of these oddly formed, ugly snowmen leaning lopsidedly around, in every park, garden, and yard. From Annie's window, you could see quite a few outside other people's houses. We made one of our own, of course, and although it was small, it wasn't that bad. It had coal for its eyes and mouth, and an old woolen hat of mine perched on its head. The arms I made from 2 school rulers. There weren't any trees or twigs around on our street. Annie loved our snowman, and would get up excitedly in the morning to peer out of her window and check he was still there. Then, on day 3, the temperature rose. It started to rain, and overnight, the snow and all the snowmen pretty much disappeared. Annie rushed to look out of her window, and her face fell at the sight of the scattered lumps of coal, sodden hats and dismembered makeshift limbs,
Where are all the snowmen?
Well, the snow has gone, I said. She looked at me impatiently.
Yes, but where are all the snowmen? Where did they go?
She couldn't understand that when the snow melted, the snowmen went too. To her, they were a separate thing. Real, solid, substantial. Snowmen. Once created, they couldn't just disappear. They had to go somewhere. I tried to explain. I told her we could make another snowman when it snowed again, but she just said,
It won't be the same. It won't be my snowman.
She was right. Some things are like that. Unique, transient. You can copy, recreate, but you can never bring them back. Not the same. I just wish Annie hadn't had to die for me to realize that. I sit on the sofa in my coat, the mysterious package on the coffee table in front of me. I didn't have a chance to open it at school. When I got back, I was already late for my next lesson. I had to use the break to catch up on marking, and by the time I made it through the last period, I just wanted to get out of the building. I even declined the offer of a Friday night drink with Beth, Susan, and James in the Fox, something I'm now regretting. Good company and a cold pint in a warm pub, even if it is the Fox, suddenly seems a much better option than a cold cottage with no TV and the only company my skittering, chittering bathroom buddies. I stare at the package. Then I pick up the scissors I found in the kitchen cupboard and carefully slit open the plastic bag. Inside is a folder bulging with papers and held together with two elastic bands. Scribbled on the front in black biro, just one word. Arnhill. I reach for my drink and take a large gulp. Every town, village, and city has a history. Often more than one. There's the official history. The bone-dry version, collated in textbooks and census reports, repeated verbatim in the classroom. Then there's the history that is passed down through generations, the stories exchanged in the pub, over cups of tea while babies squirm in buggies, in the work canteen, and the playground. The secret history. In 1949, a cave-in at Arnhill Colliery buried 18 miners beneath several tons of rubble and suffocating dust. It became known as the Arnhill Colliery disaster. Only 15 bodies were ever recovered. Locals would recall how the bellowing tremor shook the whole village. At first, people thought it was an earthquake. People ran, panicking, out of their houses. The teachers ushered children quickly out of their classes. Only the older villagers didn't run. They remained, supping their pints and exchanging troubled looks. They knew it was the pit. And when the pit roared like that, you were probably already too late. After the roar came the dust, black, billowing clouds that filled the sky and eclipsed the sun. The high-pitched wail of the colliery alarm shrieked to the dark heavens, followed by the sirens, ambulance, fire, and police. There were reports and inquiries, but no one was ever held to account for the accident. And the three lost miners remained buried, deep beneath the ground. Officially. Unofficially. Because who would ever tell such things to an outsider or a newspaper? Many swore, my granddad included, especially after a few pints, that they had seen the missing men up on the colliery site at night. One urban legend, retold with fresh embellishments each time, had it that a few of the surviving crew were sitting drinking in the Bull after hours one night when the door burst open and Kenneth Dunn, the youngest of the men lost that day, at just 16, walked right up to the bar, bold as day and black as the night with coal dust. Allegedly. The barman put down the glass he was drying, looked the dead lad up and down and said, "Get out of here, Kenneth, you're underage." A good ghost story, and every village has plenty of those. Of course, no miner would admit to being in there that night. And when asked about it, the barman, long retired by then, would just tap his red-veined nose and say, "You'd have to buy me a lot of drink to tell you that tale." No one ever did buy him enough drink, although plenty tried. Just off the high street stood the Miners' Welfare. Not the original building. That was demolished in the 60s when subsidence caused a wall to collapse, crushing several miners and their families. Two women and one toddler died. People claimed that the little boy still roamed the new building, and sometimes you'd see him in the long, dark corridor between the main bar and the toilets. As a kid, left to sip pop while Dad downed beer and Mum drank half a lager and lime while rocking Annie in her pram, because Friday was family social night at the Welfare, I would will my bladder to hold until we got home. If I absolutely had to go, I'd run as fast as I could down that dingy corridor to the toilets and back, terrified that one night I might feel a cold hand around my wrist and turn to see a tiny boy, face still smeared with dust, clothes ragged and torn, a bloody red dent in his head where his skull had been crushed. In 1857, a man by the name of Edgar Horn stabbed his wife to death and was hanged from a lamppost by a lynch mob, his body left in a shallow grave on unconsecrated ground. Legend had it that he was still alive when he was buried. He clawed his way out and could sometimes be seen, dirt crusted on his hair and clothes, sitting by his wife's headstone. On bonfire night, instead of a guy, for years the tradition in Arnhill was to burn an effigy of Edgar Horn, to make sure that this time he was really dead. My dad would always scoff at such things. If he heard Grandad telling the story about Kenneth Dunn, his face would darken and he'd say, "Leave it, Frank. There's more hot air spouted out your mouth than out the pit stack." But sometimes, the way he said it made me think he wasn't angry, but afraid. His words not derision, but a defense against stuff he'd rather not think about. Even my dad couldn't deny that Arnhill was a village plagued by misfortune. There were never any more fatal accidents down the pit, but several smaller ones claimed time, money, and in one case, a miner's legs. The pit gained a reputation for being jinxed. Some miners were reluctant to send their sons down there. Despite still being profitable, with tons of coal beneath the surface, in 1988, the decision was made to close Arnhill Colliery for good. Whatever remained down there would be left, abandoned and undisturbed. I flip through page after page of the folder. It makes for morbidly fascinating reading. Some of it I know, or thought I knew. There are details I wasn't aware of, facts obscured in the retelling. I'd always imagined Edgar Horn as a boorish monster. In fact, he was a doctor respected in the community. Until one hot summer night he went to church, ate a supper of potato broth, and cut his wife's throat with a scalpel as she slept. Remarkably, no villagers were ever held accountable for his lynching, all covering each other's backs. I wondered how many of their descendants still live in Arnhill today, and how many know, or care, about the blood on their forefathers' hands. Further back, the history of the village becomes vaguer, the usual tales of poverty, disease, and untimely death. A lot of death. Some pages have been highlighted. I lift one of them out. Nottinghamshire's Salem. During the 16th century, witch hunts were prolific across Europe. The trials in Arnhill began when a young man by the name of Thomas Darling accused his aunt of consorting with devils to bring back babies from the dead. According to Darling, Mary Walkenden took ill babies up to caves in the hills and exchanged their souls for eternal life. The name Darling doesn't ring a bell, but I remember a Jamie Walkenden at school. The boss really does never leave, I think. Generation after generation, born, living, dying here. I place the page to one side and pick out another. Zechariah Hearst, Miracle Man, 1794 to 1867. Hearst was a renowned spiritual faith healer, alleged to have performed many miracles. Witnesses claim that Hearst cured a young boy of paralysis of the legs, banished the devil from a woman, and gave breath to a stillborn baby. Most of these took place in Nottinghamshire, in a small village called Arnhill. Hearst. Hearst? Not a coincidence, surely. And a charlatan healer seems to fit the family tradition. Miracles and tragedies. Tragedies and miracles. You can't have one without the other. I turn over the next page. My breath feels like it's been sucked from my lungs. Search for missing 8-year-old continues. Annie's face smiles back at me. Wide, gappy smile. Hair in a high ponytail. Mum always tried to plait it, but Annie would never sit still for long enough. Always wanting to be off doing something else. Always looking for an adventure. Always following me. I don't need to read this story. I lived it. I push the folder away, reach for my drink, and realize the glass is empty. Odd how that happens. I stand, and then I pause. I thought I heard something. A creak from the hallway. A floorboard. Shit. Gloria. I turn, and my legs almost give out on me. Not Gloria. Hey up, Joe.
15. Life is not kind. Not to any of us, in the end. It adds weight to our shoulders, the heaviness to our stride. It tears away the things we care about and hardens our souls with regret. There are no winners in life. Life is ultimately all about losing. Your youth, your looks, but most of all, those you love. Sometimes I think it's not the passing of the years that really ages you, but the passing of the people and the things you care about. That kind of aging can't be smoothed away by needles or plumped out with fillers. The pain shows in your eyes. Eyes that have seen too much will always give you away. Like mine. Like Marie's. She sits awkwardly upon the sagging sofa, knees together, hands clasped tightly on top. She is thinner, much thinner, than the blossoming teenage girl I remember. Back then her cheeks were round with deep dimples when she smiled. Her limbs were long and lithe, cushioned with the firm flesh of youth. Now, the legs in skinny jeans are stick thin. Her cheeks are hollow. Her hair is still thick, dark and shiny. It takes me a moment to realize that it must be a wig. Her eyebrows, artful pencil lines. I hover, equally awkwardly. I swept up the papers I had been reading back into the folder, which I clutch beneath one arm. I don't know how much Marie saw. I don't know how long she'd been standing there after she let herself in when I didn't hear her knock. At least she said she knocked. Can I get you a drink? Tea? Coffee? Something stronger? The sentence makes me wince a little. Cliché, I mentally note in red pen. She tilts her head. Her hair falls to one side, just like it used to. How strong? Beer? Bourbon? Of course you haven't tried my coffee. A tiny hint of a smile. Beer, thanks. I nod and walk into the kitchen. My heart is pounding.
I feel a little faint. It's probably just my hollow stomach. I really should eat something. Or have a soft drink. More alcohol is just going to make me feel worse. I open the fridge and take out 2 beers. Before I return to the living room, I open the cupboard beneath the sink and chuck the folder inside. Then I walk back and place a can on the coffee table in front of Marie. I pop mine open and take a deep swig. I was wrong. It doesn't make me feel worse. It doesn't make me feel better either, but that's not really the point. I sit heavily in the armchair. So, it's been a long time, I say, like the cliché spouting machine I am tonight.
It has. Are you going to tell me I haven't changed a bit?
I shake my head.
We all change.
She nods, reaches for her drink and pops the tab.
Yeah. But we're not all dying of cancer.
The bluntness of her words takes me back. And then, as she tips back the beer, I realize this is not her first drink.
I presume you know, she says.
This is Arnhill, after all. I nod.
How's the treatment going?
Not working. Tumor is still spreading. More slowly. But it's just delaying the inevitable.
I'm sorry.
Cliché after fucking cliché. After the crash, I used to hate it when people told me how sorry they were.
Why?
Did you cause the crash?
No?
Then what are you sorry for,
exactly?
What have the doctors said?
Not a lot. They're too scared of Stephen to give me a straight answer. He says they don't know everything anyway. Reckons he can get me into a clinical trial in America. The Barden Hope Clinic. Some new miracle treatment.
Zechariah Hirst. Miracle man. I think, and then, hot on its heels, Maria's not going to die. I will not let that happen.
Did he say what the treatment is?
I ask. She shakes her head.
No, but I'd try anything.
She fixes her sunken eyes on mine.
I want to live. I want to see my boy grow up.
Of course. And we'd all do the same. Even though there are no miracles. Not without a price.
I look away. We both swig our beer. Funny how the more you share, the less you have to say.
You're teaching at the academy,
she says eventually.
That's right, I say.
Must be a bit weird.
A little. Now I'm one of the guards, not one of the inmates.
What made you come back?
An email, a compulsion, unfinished business. All of those and none of those. Basically, I always knew I would.
I don't know, really. The job came up and it seemed a good opportunity.
For what?
How do you mean?
It was just a surprise hearing you were back. I never thought I'd see you again.
Well, you know me. A bad penny.
No, she says. You were one of the good ones, Joe.
I feel my cheeks redden and suddenly I'm 15 again, basking in the glow of her approval.
What about you? I say. You never left?
A small, lifeless shrug.
Things always seemed to get in the way, and then Stephen proposed.
And you said yes?
Why wouldn't I?
I think about a 15-year-old girl crying on my shoulder, a bruise around her eye, a promise that she would never let it happen again.
I thought you had plans.
Well, they don't always work out, do they?
I didn't get the grades I wanted. Mum was made redundant. We needed extra money, so I got a job, and then I got married. End of.
Not quite, I think.
And you have a son?
You know I do.
Yeah, real chip off the old block. Bet his dad's proud.
A glance so sharp I feel it sting.
We're both proud of Jeremy.
Really?
You don't have kids?
No.
You don't get to judge, then.
She crumples her can.
Got another?
Are you sure? Well, it's hardly going to kill me. I stand and fetch two more cans from the kitchen. Then I pause. Marie must have driven here. I saw her slip her car keys into her handbag. She probably shouldn't drink any more and drive home. Not my problem, though. I walk back through and hand her a beer. She looks around and shivers.
This place is cold.
Yeah, the heating doesn't work very well. But that's not it.
Why here?
It just came up.
Like the job?
Yeah.
You're so full of shit.
And there it is. The bitter ball she's been waiting to cough up since she arrived.
If you've come back to start stirring up the past, she says.
What? What are you scared of? What's Hurst scared of? She takes a moment to reply. When she does, her voice is softer.
You went away. The rest of us, we're still here. I'm asking you, just leave things be. Not for Stephen. For me.
And I get it. He sent you, didn't he? I say. His thugs didn't work, so he thought you might tug at my heartstrings, persuade me, for old time's sake.
She shakes her head. If Stephen wanted you gone, he wouldn't send me. He'd send someone to finish the job Fletcher's boys started.
Fletcher's boys?
Of course. Stocky and unwise hair. That's why they seemed familiar. I should have guessed.
Fletch was always the brainless muscle when we were kids. Now his offspring are carrying on the tradition.
I really should have spotted the family resemblance, I say.
The way their knuckles dragged on the floor.
Her face flushes. And I do feel a tug inside.
But it's not my heartstrings. It's the depressing yank you get on your guts when your worst fears about someone are confirmed. You knew about my welcome party.
Which explains why she didn't ask about my bruised face when she arrived. Not until afterwards. I'm sorry.
Me too.
She stands. I should go. This was stupid. A waste of time.
Not completely. You can give Hurst a message.
I don't think so.
Tell him I have something of his.
I doubt there's anything you have that Stephen wants.
Call it a memento. From the pit.
For Christ's sake, it was 25 years ago. We were just kids.
No. My sister was just a kid.
It probably says something about me that I feel pleased when her thin, sallow face falls. I'm sorry about Annie, she says.
And what about Chris?
That was his choice.
Was it? Why don't you ask Hurst something else? Ask him if Chris really jumped. 16. 1992.
Chris found it.
That was his knack, finding stuff.
Like me, he was an unusual addition to Hurst's gang.
Tall and lanky with white blonde hair that stuck up like electrified straw, and a stutter that got worse when he was nervous. And like most awkward nerdy kids, Chris spent a lot of his school days being nervous. No one could fathom why Hurst took him under his wing, but I got it. Hurst may have been a bully, but he was also smart. He had a way of knowing who to crush and who to keep. And Chris had his uses. I guess we all did. While Hurst's casual associates were the usual mixture of posers and brawlers, his inner circle was a little different. Fletch was the muscle, the brainless thug who would laugh at Hurst's jokes, lick his arse and smash heads. Chris was the brains, the misfit, the misunderstood genius. His flair for science helped us create the best homemade stink bombs, ingenious booby traps for unsuspecting victims, and, once, a chemical explosion that caused the whole school to be evacuated at the expense and job of a stand-in science teacher. But Chris had another useful quirk. A feverish curiosity. A desire to find out stuff, and to find stuff. A way of seeing things that other people couldn't.